Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Listeners, please be careful out there today. As we're recording this on Monday afternoon, there is snow in our mountain areas with up to a foot forecast at higher elevations, and snow forecast to reach as low as 3,000 feet. It's raining and windy across most of the rest of the county, so please use caution if you're out there on the roads. Santee's City Council got an earful at recent council meetings over a controversy involving a transgender person in the Santee YMCA women's locker room. A teenage girl started a firestorm of controversy after she complained of seeing what she called a naked man after showering, but it turns out that's not accurate, and there's more to the story. Now the transgender woman is speaking out to set the record straight that started the whole controversy. We'll have details and sound bites on today's show. A false alarm at Lemon Avenue Elementary School last week reporting a shooter had parents and neighbors concerned as a SWAT team and other law enforcement descended on the campus. Learn more on our show today. From California News Service, hear why the proposed merger of supermarket giants Albertsons and Kroger is causing concern in some rural communities. Next up, we'll have a report on the La Mesa City Council's actions to approve a 5-story apartment building in the heart of the historic downtown district and why residents are divided on this issue. A local landmark in East County has gone up in smoke, literally, with the loss of the Manzanita Diner in Boulevard to a fire. If you're a senior age 65 and up, we'll tell you how you can have a wild time in February, which is Seniors Month at the San Diego Zoo Safari Park. Then on Destination East County, hear about more upcoming events, including concerts, plays, hikes, and more, coming up across San Diego's inland region in February. Children, especially in communities of color, are still struggling academically after pandemic lockdowns, and we'll have details about a new program to help them in California. If you'd like to volunteer to help others in your community, hear how you can get involved with our region's Trauma Intervention Program, or TIP. The county has completed a survey of broadband internet access in our county's unincorporated areas, and you might be surprised at the results. We'll have some national news on today's show from Public News Service, including details on a bill on police reforms in Congress, a partisan divide over the debt ceiling limit and whether it should be raised, and voting rights concerns. Then on the Yonder Report, also from Public News Service, learn why some rural communities are experiencing population growth. San Diego Sheriff stations and substations now have naloxone kits available that you can pick up to help save a life in the event of an overdose, and we'll have details. Later on, we'll be sharing two of our Best of East County episodes today, starting with a Sounds of History episode recalling an infamous jailbreak in El Cajon. And finally, we'll take you on the road to the Desert View Tower in Jacumba, one of East County's quirkiest and most iconic roadside attractions. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Emotions ran strong at recent Santee City Council meetings where heated testimony focused on a transgender woman's use of the women's locker room at the Santee YMCA. It all started earlier in January when 17-year-old Rebecca Phillips testified to the council, claiming she felt afraid after seeing what she described as a naked man in the locker room. Her testimony prompted protest rallies at the YMCA, organized by concerned parents and conservative activists, including Carl DeMaio. Phillips appeared on right-wing talk shows, including Tucker Carlson on Fox News, making headlines as far away as London, England, in British tabloids that sensationalized the story. But it turns out the person she saw was Christine Wood, a transgender woman who has fully transitioned, including surgery, so she no longer has male anatomy. Phillips later clarified she only saw Wood from behind. Wood previously sued another local gym that initially denied her access to a women's locker room after she started transitioning from being a male, and said she was harassed in the men's locker room. That gym reached a settlement with Wood. Since then, she's been taking water aerobics classes at the YMCA at the advice of her doctor for heart health and to lose weight. The YMCA has assured Phillips that she was never in any danger and says its policy is to assure that everyone is treated with respect. The showers do have curtains for privacy, but the locker rooms do not. The Y has indicated it is reviewing its locker room layout. A large group of supporters turned out to cheer on Christine Wood when she testified January 24th at the Santee City Council meeting. Here's what she had to say.
Let's go ahead and call our speakers.
So Christine Wood is first.
I just want to let you know that since the person that brought this to our attention had 3 minutes to speak, I'm going to make sure that you have 3 minutes to speak also. Welcome.
Starting now?
There you go.
Good evening. My full name is Kristen Lily Renee Wood. I'm 66 years old and reside in East County, just about 3.1 miles from there. I'm a San Diego County retiree after 29 years of civil service with the Health and Human Services Agency. I'm a member of the Cameron YMCA for about a year now. Absolutely love my water aerobics classes there. Those classes have helped me lose 60 pounds in the last year, and the health benefits have been phenomenal. It appears that I inadvertently caused quite a scandal on the morning of Thursday, December 29th, 2022, after another wonderful class. And by the way, they're all great classes. I had just showered, dressed, and hugged our instructor, Peggy, wished her and some of my other office sisters a wonderful new year, and departed the locker room for Palm Springs. It was on the morning of Thursday, December 12th, that my office sister, Vicki, called to say, "Chrissy, I'm so sorry about what happened last night at Santee." I replied, "Well, what happened?" Her answer was, "Oh my God, you don't know, do you? Let me see you the Instagram video." I watched it and I collapsed in tears. Since then, the amount of organized hatred and lies to vilify and demonize me and other members of the transgender community has truly been disheartening and disgusting. I'm here to spread the light of truth in the face of these inaccuracies. I'm a mom, a grandma, and as my beloved granddaughter says, my nan. Now please look at me. Listen to the sound of my voice. I am a threat to no one. In the year I've been a member of the Y, children have attended summer camp and have been with their parents and grandparents in a women's locker room meeting, and there has never, ever been an incident, ever. Not until one was manufactured using this form to do so. Transgender is simply a medical condition, as is my need to wear corrective lenses when I drive, my high blood pressure, and my type 2 diabetes. I am fully transitioned, asking to be confirmed with my doctor at church, who is also my gynecologist. I am sorry that this form was previously used to spread lies and a hateful political agenda. God bless you all for this opportunity. And in the words of Maya Angelou, a wise woman wishes to be no one's enemy, and a wise woman refuses to be anyone's victim. I am a threat to no one. Bless you all.
Thank you. 13 speakers also spoke in favor of Wood. Several others spoke against her and other transgender people using the locker room of their choice, which state law requires. A vitriolic diatribe was delivered by Carrie Prejean Baller, a former beauty queen who drew controversy for her anti-gay marriage remarks during the pageant. Here's what Baller had to say before her microphone was cut off when she ran over time and refused to leave the podium. And warning, she used strong language and terms that some may find offensive.
Thank you. I'm identifying tonight as Christy Lynn Wood, so I have 3 minutes. This is war. This is a war on women, children, and the truth, capital T. And the enemy is disguised in high heels, lipstick, and a shaved beard. Trying to slap down their flag, redefine words, and demand all obey or else. This is a spiritual, psychological war. and the enemy has been exposed. Cultural appropriation is wrong and gender appropriation is wrong. I am a woman, a true woman, and I'm here tonight because I have something called a motherly instinct. That's what I have innately as a woman. And my job is to protect my children. And that's why I'm here. That's something real women have. This is not about equality. This is about complete domination and superiority. We're not going to accept this. Where is the equality and protection for Rebecca Phillips? Where is her protection? This is about the protection of children and women. Never in the history of our country have we created policies based on gender ideologies, based on lies. Lies. There is no such thing as a transitioning gender. That is a made-up fantasy. It doesn't matter if you chop your penis off. It doesn't make you a woman. It doesn't make you a woman. It makes you unwell. And this is serious. We are not going to bow down to your gender ideology cult. We're not. Your fantasy land. It doesn't make it real because it's your fantasy land. So here's what needs to happen tonight. You guys, while you still have your balls, do something about it. Okay? While you still have them, while you can, do something about this. We need protection for the little Rebeccas. I don't know if any of you have daughters, but if your daughter was in that locker room, what would you have done? Thank God maybe many of you weren't in there, because I know a lot of men would have gone in and it would have been ugly. So if we want to talk about...
Stop.
I get
stop.
More time.
Your time is up.
Now, after public comments ended, Mayor John Minto said he and Vice Mayor Laura Koval had met with the YMCA and conferred with the city's legal team. Mayor Minto concluded, "We are going to make sure that everybody is safe and everybody is valued in our community." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
A false alarm triggered a heavy police response at Lemon Avenue Elementary School in La Mesa on January 24th, and alarm among some community members. Residents received a Nixcel alert from La Mesa Police warning of police activity. Neighbors reported seeing 15 to 20 police cars and a SWAT team race to the scene with a police helicopter circling overhead. A short time later, around 4:20 p.m., the La Mesa Police Department announced on social media that it had received a call reporting an active shooter at the school, but that it was a false alarm. The update stated that officers were still on scene, but that there was no active threat to the community. The principal of Lemon Avenue Elementary, Natalie Jaeger, sent a message to parents explaining that after most students were dismissed, the school's digital emergency response systems were being tested, and a call was mistakenly sent to the La Mesa Police Department. She added, "The police responded as we would expect and sent emergency response teams to our campus to ensure the safety of the staff and students in the after-school program. Please be assured that all is well and no one was ever in any danger." On the La Mesa Happenings Facebook page, some parents voiced dismay that families and neighbors were mistakenly left terrified, as one parent put it. Another reported that with the school in lockdown, parents were advised not to come to the school, heightening concerns. Several voiced dismay at not being informed about what children may have seen. One mother posted a photo of armed officers running on campus. Another said her young daughter told her, "Police with big guns came." But other parents expressed relief to see such a swift and strong law enforcement response, given the tragic failure of officers to save children during the Uvalde, Texas mass shooting. "That's fantastic that so many police came and we're ready," one parent concluded of the Lemon Avenue school incident, adding, "That makes me feel safer." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
This is Miriam Raftery with a local government report from La Mesa. At its January 10th meeting, the La Mesa City Council ratified the Design Review Board's approval of the Palm Avenue apartments, which are slated to be built at the same site where the historic Randall Lamb Building burned down during the 2020 George Floyd riots. The five-story building would house 64 rental units with only 29 parking spaces. That's less than one for each unit. There will also be room for at least one business in the building, where apartment rents are expected to start around $1,000 for units designated as affordable and run from about $2,100 to $2,900 for other units, according to the developer, Palm Street Ventures, LLC. In public testimony, some project opponents argued that increased parking problems could tarnish the village's charm. Some speakers also showed concern over the affordable units being located on the bottom floor, subjecting those tenants to a higher likelihood of property theft. Previously, some residents complained about lack of notice about the project, which was on the Design Review Board's agenda, though no notices were sent to nearby residents or businesses. There is no legal requirement to do so, according to the city, though some other communities have broader mandatory or voluntary announcements of major projects. In public testimony, Gary Loren said he moved from Irvine to La Mesa in part because of the downtown historic district's charm. He told the council, "I speak here tonight in favor of maintaining and growing that charm rather than seeing it diminished by ill-advised development projects." Lauren Cazares was one of a few La Mesa residents who showed support for the project. She contended that community character is used as a cop-out for not building these affordable housing and mixed-use housing elsewhere, and she argued that the project would not harm the area's charm. City Attorney Glenn Sabine reminded the public that the deadline had passed to file an appeal on the site's location, so the council could only make decisions on the new development's design. In the end, the council voted 4-0 to approve the Design Review Board's approval of the project, with Councilmember Laura Lothian abstaining because her office is close to the site, just a block away. Although precluded from voting, Councilmember Lothian alluded to concerns about preserving downtown character in an invocation that she delivered. She praised a new property improvement grant program that's helping small businesses get funding from the city for new signs, landscaping, awnings, and more, encouraging more local businesses to apply. And she added, many communities have found ways to retain their small-town values, historic character, and sense of community, yet sustain a prosperous economy. And they've done it without accepting the kind of cookie-cutter development that has turned many communities into faceless places that young people flee, tourists avoid, and no longer instill a pride in residents. She quoted Mark Twain, who stated, "We take stock of a city like we take stock of a man. The clothes or appearance are the externals by which we judge." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The proposed merger between supermarket giants Albertsons and Kroger is raising alarm bells in rural communities worried about the impact on consumers, farmers, and workers. Together, the companies own 734 Albertsons, Safeway, Vons, and Ralph's stores in the state and have indicated that between 100 and 350 could be sold off. Stacy Mitchell with the nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance says consolidation among grocery chains allows them to squeeze more profit on both ends by lowballing farmers and raising prices for customers.
We've seen food production workers and farmers getting paid less. We see consumers paying more for groceries. You've got the middlemen, including the supermarket chains, who are becoming incredibly profitable.
Albertsons and Kroger have assured workers that the new owners of any stores they sell will honor union agreements. But UCLA professor Chris Tilley, an expert in urban planning and economics, says that is no guarantee.
Workers are rightly skeptical of that, particularly because when Albertsons and Safeway merged, they spun off 168 stores. And quite soon, a lot of those stores closed.
Congress recently passed two bills to improve oversight of large mergers. Mitchell says the Merger Filing Fee Modernization Act will allow federal agencies to charge the companies more to review mega transactions so they can hire enough staff to conduct a proper review.
The Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice are woefully underfunded in terms of their antitrust activities. The size of those agencies really has not kept pace with the growth in the economy, and we have a significant monopoly problem.
The new State Antitrust Enforcement Venue Act will help state attorneys general keep the case in their selected courts and prevent large companies from venue shopping to find a judge that the company thinks could be sympathetic. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
An early morning fire on January 17th has destroyed the Manzanita Diner in Boulevard. Long a popular stop for motorists traveling along historic old Highway 80, the building has housed a pizzeria and Italian restaurant, as well as an earlier Basque restaurant. The diner had also been a gathering place for community events through the years. Manzanita Diner is the latest in a string of diners shutting down across East County. In late January, Major's Diner, a 50s-style diner eatery in Pine Valley, announced that it lost its lease. In recent years, Barrett Junction Cafe, near Barrett Reservoir, closed its doors after struggling to stay profitable, and the Campo Diner closed permanently due to contamination of its well water. Although the Manzanita Diner's historic facade is still standing, Cal Fire Public Information Officer Thomas Schutz told East County Magazine it was a total loss. Schutz said fire crews found the structure half engulfed in flames, with the fire spreading quickly. The fire was too intense to save the Manzanita Diner, so crews had to focus on defensive actions to save surrounding buildings, Schutz added. Schutz said the owners indicated that the building was not insured, though they do have business insurance that may cover equipment. The building, which Schutz estimated to date back to around the 1920s or 30s, was constructed of concrete blocks, but had a wood roof and siding that burned quickly. The sheriff's bomb arson squad is working to determine the cause of the fire, as is customary. Nobody was injured in the fire. The Red Cross provided assistance to 2 people in a dwelling behind the restaurant who lost power due to the fire. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
Welcome. This is East County Magazine's Animal Tales.
If you're a senior age 65 and up, you're invited to go wild at the San Diego Zoo Safari Park in Escondido, where through February, there is no admission charge for seniors. You can enjoy the sights on an Africa tram, see the platypuses and other Aussie specials at Walkabout Australia, wander through Tiger Trail, take a stroll around the Mombasa Lagoon, and relax with refreshments on the patio at Kijami Overlook. There's a world of sights to see at the Safari Park. A valid photo ID is required for the senior admission, and parking is not included. The complimentary senior admission is valid only at the Safari Park, not the San Diego Zoo. For more information, you can visit sdzsafaripark.org.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And Jonathan Getz with Destination East County.
Featuring the top festivals and events coming up across San Diego's East County.
Lamplighters Theater in La Mesa presents The Revlon Girl, evoking a 1966 disaster in Aberfan, England, where mining waste slid downhill onto a school, killing many people. The play depicts 4 women who lost their children and the volunteers who helped them to heal. The Revlon Girl is playing now through February 5th. For tickets, visit lamplighterslamesa.com.
Mission Trails Regional Park invites you to a star party held on the first Friday each month. You can join members of the San Diego Astronomy Association at the far end of the Kumeyaay Lake Campground's day-use parking lot to view the nighttime sky through telescopes. The next star party will be on Friday, February 3rd, starting at dusk. Rain or cloudy skies will cancel this event.
You can also join experienced Mission Trails Regional Parks tracking team members on Saturday, February 4th from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. for an adventure in wildlife tracking on the Oak Grove Loop Trail. Learn the art of discovering and identifying tracks and other signs left behind by the park's wildlife. These easy walks are suitable for the whole family. Walks start from the front of the visitor center on the first Saturday of every month at 8:30 a.m. Don't forget to wear long pants for kneeling on the ground, wear sturdy closed-toed shoes, and bring along water. A hat and sunscreen are also recommended. Walks are canceled if raining.
Mission Trails Regional Park also hosts a Birding Basics class on Saturday, February 25th from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Participants will learn techniques to identify birds at a glance, as well as how to use a field guide. Classes meet at the Visitor Center in Classroom A on the last Saturday of every month. You can find information about Star Parties, Mission Trails Regional Park, tracking and birding basics classes at the Mission Trails Regional Park website, which is mtrp.org.
The Wildlife Research Institute presents Hawk Watch each Saturday in February at 10:30 a.m. at Beegent Ranch in Ramona. Arrive at 9:30 for coffee and donuts. Hawk Watch is an informative educational biologist's talk, plus questions and answer sessions with falconry experts and ambassador raptors for you to see up close and personal. The seated program lasts approximately 1.5 to 2 hours and is followed by an option for additional roadside observations of wild raptors and other wildlife, including a bald eagle nest, where you'll drive your own car fewer than 2 miles on paved roads. Biologists and local expert volunteer observers will help you spot and identify birds through high-powered professional telescopes. After the program, you can hike the Ramona Grassland Preserve hiking trail. It is recommended to bring binoculars and a folding chair if you have them, a jacket or other layered clothing, and sturdy shoes for uneven terrain. For more information, visit wildlife-research.org/hawkwatch.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions across San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
Many of California's 13.5 million children and teens have not bounced back after the pandemic, especially children of color. That's according to the just-released 2023 California County Scorecard of Children's Well-Being. The report showcases data from all 58 counties and shows wide disparities in indicators of health, education, and more. Kelly Hardy with Children Now says anti-poverty measures during COVID helped a lot, but they were just temporary.
38% are in families making less than 2 times the poverty level, which is around $60,000 a year for a family of 4. So that's a pretty low bar.
The data show that the state has more than 170,000 homeless students, and the shortage of state-funded childcare continues. The report found in 2017, 2019, and 2021, only 1 in 4 working families had access to a space in a licensed childcare facility. Susanna Niffen, also with Children Now, says kids in foster care had alarmingly low scores for access to health care and for academic achievement.
These kids are facing distinct challenges that other students aren't, and they need a very targeted approach to their education if we're ever going to change the numbers, which are fairly dismal.
Vince Stewart, Vice President of Policy and Programs with Children Now, says in terms of education, kids appear to be losing ground as they get older.
42% of third graders met or exceeded standards in reading. 31% of fifth graders met or exceeded standards in science. And 29% of eighth graders met or exceeded standards in math. And then 11th graders, it's only 27% who were deemed ready for college level math.
The report does show some bright spots. California's children have high rates of health insurance, and a high proportion of babies are born at normal birth weight. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, Get trained to be a citizen journalist and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Neighbors helping neighbors in crisis. That is what local nonprofit Trauma Intervention Programs of San Diego, or TIP, thrives on. For over 37 years, TIP volunteers have been responding to a continuous, high-demand need of crisis intervention requests in San Diego County, and more volunteers are needed. Providing crisis intervention immediately after a tragedy and working side by side with emergency partner agencies, TIP volunteers add compassionate support to the emergency response system. Specially trained volunteers offer care and support to residents who have been traumatized by a personal tragedy or are in a state of crisis. Often survivors are alone in shock and dismay following a sudden tragedy. TIP partners with local fire departments, law enforcement, and hospitals to offer crisis intervention 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Volunteers are trained to respond to a variety of tragedies, such as house fires, drowning, sudden infant death, suicide or attempted suicide, homicide, vehicle accidents, overdoses, sudden deaths from natural causes, and community disasters. TIP volunteers have provided over 51,000 hours of service while assisting over 8,700 citizens in crisis and relief for emergency responders last year. The need is there, and what's also needed are compassionate volunteers to help our community. This year, TIP will host three training academies throughout San Diego County for people who want to join this elite group of dedicated individuals, including a training academy in East County starting in February. There is no experience required. Registration space is limited. You can get more information or sign up for a training academy to become a TIP volunteer at tipssandiego.org. and click on their volunteer link or call 855-TIP-SD-HELP. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
A recent analysis of census data as part of San Diego County's comprehensive broadband plan shows that approximately 37 households in the unincorporated area of our county don't have a broadband internet subscription. This puts them at a disadvantage when it comes to things like online education, healthcare services, or emergency notifications. Reliable and affordable internet access is a basic need in today's connected world. Just ask Warner Springs resident and emergency volunteer Melissa Crow, who recently signed up for Starlink internet after years of suffering with less than stellar service. She says having a reliable way to communicate can very literally be a matter of life or death for us in the rural communities, whether it is the need to check on our elderly, call 911 in an emergency, or for educational purposes. Being connected is an important aspect of modern life, she says, adding, all of my neighbors in the rural communities should be able to procure reliable internet for themselves and their families. The county's report is the county's latest effort to address inadequate broadband infrastructure and access in communities. The comprehensive broadband plan supports the county's efforts to close that digital divide in the unincorporated area by identifying problems, as well as the partnerships, infrastructure, and education needed to change that. Here are more shocking findings from the county's survey. 92% of surveyed residents in the unincorporated area did not have an internet subscription at home due to availability, reliability, or affordability. 58% of these residents say internet access is not available in their area. 19% say internet access is too expensive, and 15% say internet speeds are too slow. Areas in need of infrastructure tend to be located in rural, desert, and mountain areas in North and East County, such as Valley Center and the Mountain Empire. These internet deserts are typically more rural, more mountainous, and have lower incomes than their suburban peers. Residents within these communities often pay higher prices for lower speed internet access than in the urban areas. Communities with low access in the region often have populations with non-English speakers, lower education levels, and higher poverty than the countywide average. Now, the county has taken some actions already to improve internet access, and more are planned. Thanks to a $4.3 million federal grant, the county library created the Tech Connect program. It puts laptops and Wi-Fi hotspots in the hands of 7,000 library users who lack access to the internet and a computer. Library cardholders can check out a laptop and an air card for 1 year free of charge. The county has partnered with SANDAG on its Get Connected campaign to advance affordable internet service and digital literacy programs. Through a partnership with Caltrans, the county has also identified opportunities to leverage already planned roadway projects and deploy fiber, as well as expand high-speed broadband service to underserved communities at the same time. So, what's next? The plan identifies areas with connectivity gaps and prioritizes them by greatest need, including lack of access and affordable options. The county will be using this plan to identify the type of infrastructure projects needed to increase connectivity in those areas, such as installing more fiber optic cables. The plan will also help the county determine how it can best collaborate with others to build regional partnerships, engaging the public and private entities to work together to expand broadband access to all county residents. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We now have the blueprint, America, and we won't accept less going forward in the future.
Civil rights attorney Ben Crump says any officer engaged in police brutality should be met with fair justice. Five black police officers were fired and charged with murder right after the death of 29-year-old Tyree Nichols of Memphis. Crump cited the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which passed the House in 2021 and would ban chokeholds and racial profiling. But the new Republican chair of House Judiciary says no legislation would prevent police violence.
Why wouldn't we sit down now, set a path to get us to a balanced budget, and let's start paying this debt off and make sure the future generation has as many opportunities as we do?
Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says he and President Joe Biden could reach a deal on deep budget cuts when they meet this week on the debt ceiling. McCarthy did concede that cuts to Social Security and Medicare are off the table despite pressure from his right. The U.S. hit its debt limit earlier this month. Treasury officials say they can prevent default until summer. Observers say 2023 will be a crucial year for voting rights.
Those on the other side are trying to discourage people from participating. That's what this really is about. We have to fight back to protect our democracy, to protect everything.
Maine Secretary of State Shayna Bellows says it'll take strong leaders to ward off systematic voter suppression. Nearly 100 bills to restrict voter access have been introduced in state houses nationwide. More than 245 bills would expand voter access or otherwise deal with election administration. A Democratic National Committee panel says it will finalize its presidential primary calendar in June. Officials in Georgia and New Hampshire say they want the extra time to adjust if South Carolina goes first. But some lawmakers, like New Hampshire Democratic Senator Jean Shaheen, are pushing back.
Now, we have a state law that says we're going to go first, so we're going to go first.
Shaheen says she'll continue to invite presidential hopefuls to her state despite a plan to penalize candidates if they ignore the new schedule. Under a DNC plan backed by President Biden, Nevada and New Hampshire would follow South Carolina. Georgia would be third, followed by Michigan. Activists on both sides are focused on Wisconsin, where a state Supreme Court seat could determine the fate of abortion rights in the swing state. Voters will head to the polls next month to choose which of four candidates, two liberal and two conservative, will move on to the general election in April. Political analysts say the GOP handed Democrats a winning issue by proposing to replace the income tax with a nationwide 30% sales tax. That would land harder on working families, but be a big break for the wealthy. Kevin McCarthy says he opposes the bill, but promised a vote to win the speaker's chair. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. The population of rural America is growing again after the recent decade-long loss. Since the pandemic, a third of non-metro counties actually gained population, according to research by the Journal of Rural Sociology. Daily Yonder data journalist Sarah Malott says growth was most pronounced in counties like Powder River, Montana, where recreational activities are a major part of the economy.
So people then associate these places with a higher quality of life.
If the trend continues, Malott says net migration will be significant.
Then we could expect rural America to grow by 1.3% by 2030. That's actually 23% higher than the projected urban rate.
One town in Iowa has found success with other attractions. Here's Anya Slepian.
The first decade of the 2000s was not kind to Newton, Iowa. The appliance company Maytag was bought out, and when their headquarters closed, 2,000 jobs went with it. Then the housing bubble burst. When no new building permits were issued in 2011, Bruce Showalter, the housing director for the Newton Housing Development Corporation, knew the town was in trouble.
If you're not building new houses or upgrading your housing stock, then you're dying. So if we didn't do something, the city was going to just deteriorate and continue to lose population.
So Newton created a new housing initiative, which provides a $10,000 cash incentive to anyone building a home worth $190,000, as well as a subscription to the local newspaper and a YMCA membership. In the past 9 years, more than 100 homes have been built, helping grow Newton's economy as well as its population.
Half of those houses have been sold to new people moving to town. So we're actually drawing people to town because of this program.
More than 50 other rural communities offer incentives, from free building lots and cash payments to complimentary dinners and internet credits. I'm Anya Slepian.
And younger people are moving back or staying in some areas. Sociologist Ben Winchester at the University of Minnesota believes the brain drain narrative no longer fits.
If rural America is dying, then why can't I find a home to buy?
In the decade following the year 2000, Winchester's research noted a significant uptick in 30 to 49-year-olds contributing to a form of brain gain in most of Minnesota's rural counties.
Rural is not dying. The narrative we're using is terrible and is based out of things that happened like 50 or 100 years ago.
Journalist Nick Foriezos from Open Campus Media looked at the Minnesota data and noted the outsized role of community colleges and their ability to adapt to local needs.
When you look at the rural areas that are really succeeding and thriving, they usually find a way to take the strengths that they have and to think creatively.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
About 45% of Black Americans have hypertension, also known as high blood pressure, compared to 31% of white Americans. And now, a new program in Southern California is working to lower those numbers. The American Heart Association is teaming up with the healthcare company Providence on a 3-year program to narrow the disparities affecting Black and Latino Californians in the LA area. Dr. David Pryor with Anthem California is co-chair of the AHA's Los Angeles Hypertension Task Force. He calls hypertension a silent killer.
A person may have high blood pressure and they don't even know it. They actually could be feeling quite normal. It really is only when the blood pressure gets more severely elevated that a person might start noticing some symptoms like headaches, chest pains, or shortness of breath.
The program is placing blood pressure kiosks in the community, providing health resources to barbershops and salons, and training community health workers. The AHA also offers a lecture series for primary care providers on treating hypertension in the Black and Latino communities. Information is online at heart.org/high blood pressure. Dr. Daniel Lewis leads the Black Physicians Council at the Providence Facey Medical Group in Tarzana. He says it's very important to know your numbers.
The way people die most of all is heart attack, and hypertension is one of the main associating factors. Unfortunately, hypertension runs highest in the Black community, and with that comes heart attack, stroke, kidney problems.
The CDC says heart attacks are the country's number one killer, taking almost 700,000 lives in 2020. That year, more than 160,000 people had fatal strokes. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is a public service announcement from the San Diego County Sheriff's Department. There are now more ways to access life-saving medication to use in case of an overdose emergency. Sheriff's deputies are handing out free harm reduction kits when they respond to calls for service, and you can also get these kits at no charge at any Sheriff's Department station or substation in San Diego County. No questions asked. The harm reduction kits contain a box of naloxone with two doses of the nasal spray. Brochures in English and Spanish provide instructions on how to use it. You can also scan a QR code in the brochure with your cell phone to watch an instructional video. The distribution program started in December, and so far, deputies have distributed 161 harm reduction kits while responding to emergency and non-emergency calls. Newly elected Sheriff Kelly Martinez says this is a compassionate approach to the opioid epidemic impacting our communities. This is about real people with families who love and care for them. This increased access to life-saving medication is in partnership with County Health and Human Services, the County of San Diego, the Chula Vista and National City Police Departments, County Probation Department, as well as County Parks and Recreation. Drug overdose is the leading cause of accidental death in our county. You can help reverse this trend by being prepared in case you encounter someone experiencing an opioid overdose. Naloxone is safe, effective, and easy to use. And for those struggling with substance abuse, you are not alone. Help is available by calling 988. You can also contact the County Crisis Hotline for confidential treatment programs and resources at 888-724-7240. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Next up, we'll be re-airing one of our Best of East County episodes, an oldie but goodie, about the infamous East County jailbreak.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, and today I am guest hosting our Sounds of History segment, bringing you another colorful story from East County's past. I have a special guest today. His name is Larry McKim, and Larry was a firefighter for many years with the El Cajon Fire Department. He's the historian for the fire department, and he's here to tell us about his own role in a very daring rescue at the old El Cajon jail, which was not exactly Alcatraz. You're going to hear why. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Well, good morning. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
So you were on duty the morning of August 24th, 1984.
Yes.
Tell us about the call that came in.
Well, we were out at the training facility, at Heartland Training Facility on North Marshall, and about an hour into the drill, we heard the radio come across as someone breaking out of the county jail there.
Which was a 10-story building about 200 feet high where the El Cajon Courthouse is now. It used to be the top three floors up there with the jail.
Correct. So the chief had sent the ambulance code 3 to pick me up at the training facility and bring me back code 3s.
And why you?
Why, I'd gone to the heavy rescue school at Port Hueneme, and so I had been trained to do heavy rescues and to perform rappelling and to teach our guys how to do the rappelling in case something like this ever occurred, not knowing that it would ever happen. But sure enough, on August 24th, it happened.
So you got to the scene, and what did you find?
When we got to the scene, we had heard by that time that somebody had fallen to his death, and the other person was still dangling from a rope on the third bottom ledge that you can see from the east side of the building.
Yeah, and these were young kids. They were a couple of 18-year-olds. The one who died, tragically, was in for burglary, and the other fellow that you were sent to rescue had been in there for a parole violation.
Correct.
18 years old.
Yes.
Okay, so you get up on top of the building, and what did your chief say to you?
Well, Chief Stray told me to go up there and take care of the rescue. And then Captain Mike Thompson at the time, he said, you tie everything off. If you die, it's going to be your own fault. So nobody else is going to take responsibility.
Great. Very encouraging words.
Yeah.
Okay, so we jumped off this building with this rope.
So I'm up there with my crew, and we started tying everything off. And then I got ready to go over the ledge, and a big guy named Jim Lockwood had a hold of me. And Jim said, I've got you, and I won't let you go. So mm-hmm. I said, okay, if you're ready, I'm ready. So he finally let me loose over the edge, and I rappelled down and went down and then pulled up about 6-8 feet to the side of this young man and then told him, you know.
Who was trapped on a ledge, right?
Trapped on a ledge.
Saw his buddy, you know, didn't make it and decided this is far enough, or he just couldn't get down.
He couldn't get down that far as he could go.
Now, what had happened? I understand they had kicked through the wall of the cell and they had
kicked the hole through the wall and then had tied mattress covers and stripped it down and tied into a long rope, basically. But if you know anything about knots, time, distance, and weight on an overhand knot will pull through. And that's exactly what happened.
Okay, so he was really trapped. He was stuck up there.
Yep, he's stuck on that ledge, just hanging onto it. And the ledge is about 9 inches long, and it sloped on a little bit of an angle so that the water will run off it.
Mm-hmm.
But he just sat there and laid there until I pulled up alongside him.
So what were you thinking when you went over the edge?
I was pretty nervous going over the edge, actually.
How long was your rope?
My rope was 200 foot long, but you figure it tied off some of it and 186 foot down to the ground.
That left you 14 feet to go when you got to the bottom.
Correct. But with Kern Mantle rope, you have a 10% stretch. So
okay. So you're pretty close.
We were pretty close at the end of the, when we got down to the ground after the rescue was over with, we were at the end of the rope.
So when you got down there and you found this guy on the ledge, what did you say to him or what did he say to you?
Well, when I got up alongside him at the edge, I told him, I said, don't touch me or any of my equipment, or you might have a long way to go down to the ground, because your life didn't mean anything to me at the time. I was, you know, pretty nervous and figured he's a prisoner, so.
Yeah. How did you get him down?
Well, I tied a pompier belt that we used to carry on our ladder trucks to keep you secured in the basket. I tied that onto him, which I immediately hooked onto me, so I knew he couldn't fall. He may be upside down if I didn't get the other safety line on him. But in the meantime, at least he was secure to me. Then I had another rope sent down from the top and then tied that on him. It's called a bullet on a coil, which we no longer use that anymore either. Just, you know, 30 years ago training, and that's what we knew and that's what we did. So today they have rescue harnesses and class one harnesses to tie and secure to people and makes it safer.
Very good. So how long did it take to finally reach
I want to say it was like 45 minutes, but it just seemed like it was seconds and minutes, you know, when I was doing the rescue. It just went by so quickly. It was interesting to, you know, to get down to the ground with him and then finally touch the earth.
Yeah. Now, you received a lot of commendations for your bravery, I understand.
Yes, former Mayor John Reber gave me Class C commendation from the city.
Mm-hmm.
My captain wrote a nice letter on me. Former Congressman Jay LeSueur, who was a lieutenant at the jail at the time, and he was in charge of the detention center. He gave me a letter. I got a letter from one of the judges there in the courthouse.
And we've seen all these. You brought in that wonderful album you have as the historian for the fire department. So after the jailbreak incident, they did make some efforts to make it more secure. They strengthened up some of the things there, but some of the windows and things. But it didn't work so well.
No, I had a couple more jailbreaks after that, so.
They did. Let's see, there was one guy that managed to get all the way out, and he was found hiding in the restroom at the courthouse. That wasn't real safe. There was another guy who got out for a whole month to go visit his dying father, and they found him a month later in a brothel and brought him back, and he was apparently the hero of the jailhouse because he actually got away with it. And then there were seven more who broke out, and as of the old newspaper articles I found, I don't think all of them were ever found. Do you know?
I have no idea if they've been caught yet today or not.
Yeah. Those guys had tied 30 bed sheets together to make their big escape. And the walls, apparently, some of them were made of styrofoam or some kind of foam material that was so lightweight they could kick it out.
Correct.
Apparently, they said the walls were more secure at the local dog pound than at the jail.
Yes, because it's made of blocks, so nobody's going to be kicking a hole through that.
County Supervisor George Bailey at the time called it a multi-million dollar turkey and said it was the least secure jail, you know, who knows, maybe anywhere, certainly in San Diego County.
Without a doubt, it had to be the least secure jail in the history of mankind.
Finally, in the 90s, they just gave up the ghost on it, and it did close down. It's not there anymore. Now it's just a courthouse building.
Correct.
Larry, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, bringing us another colorful tale from East County's past here on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region. Please support KNSJ by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Hayden Parsley, on the road in Hacumba Hot Springs for East County Magazine. You can take a trip into California's past at the Desert View Tower, a quirky and whimsical relic of the past that is still open to the public here in San Diego's East County. Located just off Interstate 8 at the Incapa exit, the tower is poised on a rocky overlook surrounded by desert on all sides. Built in the 1920s by Bert Vaughn, a real estate tycoon who owned much of Hacumba, this 70-foot watchtower has become a tourist attraction and a local landmark on the outskirts of the small town known as Hacumba Hot Springs. Originally built to commemorate the area's rough pre-highway history, the tower houses a small museum filled with artifacts and oddities of California's history, including our region's Native American, Spanish, and pioneer past. The top floor of the tower is an observation deck, with a coin-fed telescope that provides a breathtaking view of Imperial Valley and the Anza-Borrego Desert, though now somewhat marred by a wind farm. In 1950, a gift shop was added around the base of the tower. The shop still operates today and is filled with an eclectic mix of items such as geodes, gems and minerals, vintage postcards, historic and travel books on our region, arts and crafts items such as handmade Tecate tiles, onyx bookends, musical instruments, carved animal sculptures, and more. Roaming this area of the tower are the owner's many friendly dogs that add to the rustic charm of the location. You can also get a workout pumping a player piano while listening to old-time tunes. While I was there, the wind was gusting. It was a bit chilly and I wished I had a better coat when I reached the top. The owner says this is atypical though and that it is warm and sunny most days. The proprietor, Ben Schultz, has many colorful stories on East County's history, culture, and colorful characters, having operated the site for many years. Boulder Park at the Desert View Tower was created in 1933 by an unemployed engineer, Merle Ratcliffe, who was out of work during the Great Depression. He sculpted reptiles and fanciful animals out of the huge stone boulders. I didn't get a chance to tour these, which will be an adventure for another time.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show. This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617. Or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests.